Nifty Podcast, presented by Party Fish Media, a showcase of the best emerging filmmakers under the age of 25 from all over the world. Film starts here at Nifty 2023 in Seattle, Washington, April 27th through the 30th, and online through May 7th. Everybody, welcome to the Nifty Podcast. My name is Robert Bohorkis. I'm a longtime programmer and supporter of Nifty, and we're super excited to be joined by a filmmaker we've got with their film Imran and Ali Khan in our Growth Spurt screening this year. Shaq, welcome.
Hey, what's up? How's it going?
Yeah, it's good to have you here. How's the festival been for you so far?
It's been awesome. It's so great.
We were just saying before we hit record that you have to leave early, and that's such a bummer.
I'm so sad. I was literally like, do I call in sick to work? Do I
yes.
Do I say my car broke down in Seattle and I can't get back home?
Whatever excuse.
Honestly, this close.
Yeah. Thanks for being here. And let's start with tell us a little bit about your film. If you can give us like the long line, a little bit of a summary for people that are listening, maybe haven't watched it or, you know, are about to go watch it right before they hit play on the rest of this interview.
Yeah. My film is called Imran and Ali Khan, and it's a queer love story at a Muslim winter camp about two boys who fall in love but have to keep their relationship a secret. And it's about the trials and tribulations of a first love and a first kiss and all those fun stuff.
Yeah, it's so sweet. It's so nice. And, you know, for those of us who've been to like a summer camp experience, I feel like there's always a little bit of like, oh, there's somebody that I want to get to know more.
And it's like, it's an interesting environment because it's so whimsical. I feel like nowadays too, without our, like, we rarely get times to be without our phones, without technology. Right. So it's one of the most like present moments that you can be in. Mm-hmm. And also like you're kind of in this bubble where like nothing in the outside world matters for like the week or the weekends. So it allows you to connect with people a lot deeper, a lot quicker. So that was a really interesting place to like set the film in.
Well, tell me more about where the idea for the story came from and how kind of it all came together.
This character of like these two characters are like based off of a lot of people in my past combined, and then the situation was based off of like when I went to a Muslim camp, and it was an interesting time to like come of age at that point, and then also just like deeply connect with people. But then also at the end of the camp, you have to say goodbye to them, which is like really interesting that you form these really deep bonds with like friends and other people, and then having to like kind of get them torn away at the end of the camp. So that's kind of where that inspiration came from. Mm-hmm. And thank God we have technology these days, because I'm still been able to keep in contact with the people from it. But I wanted to set a world where these characters didn't have that access, and like they had to get torn.
I think there's an iPod shuffle, and that's kind of the only technology we see, right?
Very that.
Can you tell me more, just because my closest, I think, comparable experience to Muslim camp is I, you know, as a young, being raised Christian to some extent, went to a Christian summer camp for a few years. Like what's defining about like the Muslim camp experience? I just don't know. They were doing the prayers and in the short, but like what else is that experience?
I think honestly it's just like community at the end of the day, like regardless of like whether it's a religious camp, whether or not you're going to like a lifeguarding camp, whether or not you're going to like a, I don't know, like, like a soccer camp, like everyone there is there because they have that common goal and that common shared experience. So that kind of breaks the ice immediately. It's like, okay, like you're here, I'm here. We probably went through the same things growing up, or we have a similar interest.
Yeah.
And I think that just automatically breaks an ice. And then I don't know if that's the right thing. Unice.
Sure.
Breaks the ice.
Something.
Breaks a little bit of the ice to allow you to have those conversations a lot quicker, because you know you have something in common that you can talk about. Like, oh, did your parents do this? Yeah, my parents did this. Boom. Instant connection. Or, oh, like you grew up with this. I grew up with this. Or, oh, we went to this like this mosque event together, kind of a thing. And, oh, your uncle is actually my uncle too. Whoa. Boom. We're cousins. Like kind of stuff like that. Or like, you know, like we realize how like small and how intricate our communities can be. And I think the idea of having something shared is a really interesting point, especially at that age where it's really like a lot of kids are really shy, and it allows you, especially you're away from home, away from parents, you're in a new environment, that shared experience, regardless of what it is. The one that I went to as a kid was a Muslim camp as well. So that was like my shared experience, but I think it is equally translatable across any like summer experience or camp experience.
Yeah.
coming of age experience.
Yeah, and that actually gets into some of my questions that are more about, like, specifically the film. I'm curious about your process for finding these leads, finding Imran and Ali Khan, and because I feel like they both had so much chemistry. I mean, we see them, like, peak chemistry, right? Dancing at the dance first, and then it jumps to the camp. But I feel like even in the moments where there's, like, shyness happening, there's still, like, something there. And so, I mean, like, tell me about finding them, matching them up, and that whole process.
Yeah, it took a team to definitely to find our leads. I was very lucky to work with the casting director, Monica Dahlman. She was incredible. And we were granted her services by the production company that we made the film through. And she did this open call, but Moheb actually came into our table read originally. Basically, the way the film got made was through the Crazy Eights Film Society up in Vancouver.
On the Nifty Podcast, I've heard of Crazy Eights before. Yeah.
Yes, they're an awesome, incredible Vancouver-based filmmaking competition. Anyone listening who's from Vancouver, I would highly recommend, like, just shooting your shot and applying for it. It's a great opportunity. But yeah, so there's, like, various stages, and at top 12 they write the script, and then we do table reads, and we get story editors, and Moheb actually came in, who plays Imran. He came into our story edit, or he came into our table read, and I saw him, and I was like, Are you booked and busy on something else? So I sent him the audition and stuff, and then he ended up reading. And then Harnoor, we got into our call from the casting director. Mm-hmm. And I remember seeing his tape, and I was like, that's our Ali Khan.
Wow.
Like, instantly. He had this, like, charm. He had this magnetic energy to him. And they're also just such great friends now as well, which is, like, really cool. And, we've really fostered this, like, community in Vancouver of, like, South Asian filmmakers that kind of, like, have all bonded and banded together. And it's been really interesting to, like, kind of make my debut with this film and be able to work with two incredible emerging, not even just actors, but, like, filmmakers that are also, like, doing the damn thing in Vancouver. Yeah.
Yeah. So is this your first short?
This is my first short. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, what brought you to filmmaking?
Yeah.
This being the first one, and it's so well done too.
Like, yeah. Thank you. Yeah. When I was really young, when I was, like, I want to say, like, 17, 18, not really young, 17, 18, I would, do stand up.
Okay.
At a local, I was underage. I would do stand-up.
How Eddie Murphy of you.
Very, very that. I would do stand-up at one of the bars, and then the pandemic happened, and then I ended up going to writing, and I wrote my first pilot, and then that was really cool. I just submitted it to this, like, random, like, open call on a whim.
Wow.
And then 6 months later, I get a call, and it's from the team at Warner Brothers, and they pick up the script for 6 months development. It's wild. It's a crazy wild story. It's a part of the Warner Media Access Writers Program in Canada. Uh-huh. And it's really great. And I got to work with, like, some of these writers that I have been admiring for years and years. And now we're, like, on a Zoom call all together. and that honestly opened the door for so much for me. And I really have to thank, like, the team, like Mel, Nafisa, and Deanna at Warner Media, because they really opened that door for me to be able to just, like, come into the industry. And then when I realized, and I was working with them, and I was like, oh, I have zero idea what I'm doing. I was like, you know, let me go make a short film first. Let me just learn. Like, I just want to see a project through completion.
Sure.
Before I were to hop onto a series. And that series, I'm very lucky, has gotten some great traction. We were able to get sponsored by Warner again to open up a development room. So I got to show run a development room for Warner, which is, like, a cool thing to say. Yeah. It feels weird to say, but it's cool. I got to work with some incredible, incredible writers from Vancouver. It was, like, an all BIPOC room.
Yeah.
We got a lot of queer folks, a lot of South Asian folks, just to come in and work on this cool show about love as well. And I felt like this was a really great, like, comp to everything else. And hopefully that show, we're, like, with the strike and everything, it's a little bit up in the air of what's going to happen with the show. But I think it's also a good time to just, like, come back and sit back and just reevaluate everything, and then and then come back when the strike's over. Yeah.
Wow, that's really exciting.
It's wild. It's so cool. It's so cool. Like, I don't know how to. I'm very, very thankful and very lucky that team saw something in me when I was think I was 19 at the time.
Yeah.
I'm 21 now, but like I still like, they saw something in me very young, and I can't say thank you enough to them.
That's great. Right. Let's bring it back to the film.
Yes.
And one thing that I kind of took note of throughout the movie, there's a little bit of a spectrum of like grand gestures, small moments. And I wanted to ask you about those small moments, because I think that that's something that people cherish in their relationships, is those little things rather than big sweeping gestures and things like that. So the two that I kind of earmarked were the iPod shuffle, where it's like, oh, cool, he's just like remarking on it. And then also the marshmallow, making the fire and the marshmallows.
Yes.
And I'm curious, from your perspective, like, what do you think is the importance of small moments like that in some, in like, you know, a romance story or just in general?
Yeah.
But I'm curious, like, where that hits for you.
Yeah. I think those small moments are so important because they just bring, as well as the director too, like, those small moments are what makes you smile as you watch the film. And it's like, oh, like, you know, and that's kind of the reaction that I want out of the audience, is like those little things. So even if it's just like a small look or a small like beat, and that's what, as like a director, you're trying to find, because you can't really write those moments.
Yeah.
You can, and sometimes they get written in there, but they can easily get lost in the page, in between like pages of dialogue and everything else. So for me, it's those moments that like we really had to search for.
Mm-hmm.
In each cut, and like kind of jigsaw puzzle things together. But I'm so thankful that I had an incredible like camera team behind me, like my DP and his whole cam op team. My DP Ollie Bian and his whole cam op team were incredible at finding those moments.
Wow.
And like pushing in at the right time and seeing an actor like get ready to do something and then like push in slowly, like they were on the ball. And we didn't have that. We did not have a short timeline. We had a very short timeline for this, because Crazy 8s is 8 days.
Yes, yeah.
So 3 days of production, 5 days of post, right away, back to back to back. And then you deliver on the fifth day. So it's like rough cut, fine cut, lock picture, color, sound.
Wow, yeah.
Done. Boom. Like each day. So we really didn't have time to like fully search for those moments. Mm-hmm. But I'm really thankful for my whole team for being able to like point them out on the day. And if I was just like, ooh, I like that, my scripty wrote it down, sent it to the editor, they knew exactly where it was. So I think for me, in finding those moments, make sure your team knows just as much about those moments that you want as much as you want it.
Yeah.
Because if you're asking someone to find them, they need to know what they're looking for.
How did you prep everybody for that, for like, you know, being on that same wavelength with you? Because I think it's that, from like a leadership perspective, I think is difficult for some, for folks to learn, I think, and or it can be. And so like, how did you kind of guide everybody toward that kind of shared goal so that people were looking out for those things?
Yeah. I think for me, there's a few things. There was one was giving comps to your actors and writers, and or your actors and your DPs and your entire team, to know what kind of thing that you want. Like if you can, as much as we want to like use words, where film is a visual medium.
Right.
So if we want to try and like express ourselves, sometimes pictures and videos and stuff, or audio is like the best way to do it. So I always make a playlist, and I send that to everyone.
Yeah.
So we're all on the same page of like what the music vibe is. And I think like you listen to the soundtrack of Call Me By Your Name, the visuals just sync so perfectly to that.
Yeah.
And like one really informs the other. So playlists and treatments and videos is really like a great way, and making sure everyone has that, making sure you're doing your standard meetings that like are in productions, and having a first AD, an incredible first AD, like Carl Figueredo is my first AD, and he did really, really well. Making sure we had all of our meetings lined up, like our concept meeting, everyone's on the same page. Mm-hmm. Everyone is in the same room and can ask as many questions as they want, and we're all on the same page. But in order for that to happen, I had to know my vision first before I asked someone else. So making sure you do your research and your homework, figuring out what you want, and then when you get to that concept meeting, everyone knows, everyone's on the same page, and you're ready to answer the questions. Which is definitely hard to learn, or definitely hard to be thrown in for the first time, but I think because of how like personal and close this story was, it was very easy. I think that the further you are from the story, the harder that is. So the more research you have to do.
Yeah.
Because you
yeah.
can't look inwards, you have to look outwards.
Yeah.
So that was my biggest piece of that, getting everyone on the same page was, yeah, making sure you know what you want.
Yeah, yeah.
And then giving your people and your team, who are also equally filmmakers as well and like love this craft,
yeah, yeah,
the tools and the information that they need to do their job to the best they can.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Homework. Even in 8 days, they're still do your homework.
Oh, do your homework. Bury that.
You said something that I want to go back to, and it was like about getting a reaction out of your audience because these credits roll in this false ending. And then immediately I'm brought back to Earth and left with an ambiguous ending that isn't the happy let's run away together ending.
Yeah.
And why did you do that to me?
I'm sorry. I'm going to be very honest. That ending, I think I want to say I wrote that a week before we went to camera.
Mm-hmm.
That ending, I feel like for me, the reason I love series is because I had a talk with my therapist about this. I have like a fear of things ending, and if, like, or I don't know what the word is, but like
right.
a fear of like just closing something off
uh-huh.
and just being done with it.
Yeah.
So for me, series is the best because you write your pilot and then you leave a little bit open, and right. then it's like, oh, haha, you have to figure out what's next.
Yeah, yeah.
I just can't end it. And I also think whenever we watch series or whenever we watch TV or we watch film, the ending is what sticks with us.
Uh huh.
Like, I'm, yeah.
You said Call Me By Your Name, and it's
right?
Timothy Chalamet staring in that fire.
It's yeah. that ending that is just like so, it's the last thing you leave with. It's yeah. the, you've invested X amount of time into this show or into this movie, and then the ending is the payoff
yeah.
for that. And I feel like for me, that was like, that was the pressure of like making sure I got the ending right and making mm-hmm. sure it was correct and it also fit the story and it was also different and unique and something that pushed the genre, because I feel like this, very honestly, like the genre of rom-com has been done to mm-hmm, death by mm-hmm. so many people in so many different ways, so beautifully, that if I'm going to do this genre, I want to make sure I have something new to say to it or something to add to it, because then there's no point in me just recreating someone else's film. I want to make sure my voice and I have something new to say to it. So that mm-hmm. was really difficult because it's hard to find something new to say in a genre like this, but I really have to thank my story editor and this other filmmaker named Tesh Gudikonda, and he really helped me with that ending
mm-hmm.
and we were just like brainstorming and he was like, what if you just rolled your credits and just said, like, held up like two middle fingers to the audience. And what I tell you, I was, okay, so we premiered it at the Crazy Eights Festival. We yeah. ended up opening the 2022 festival to over 1500 people
wow.
in this grand theater in downtown Vancouver. When I tell you, I was about to cry before the film premiered because I was so stressed that either people wouldn't fall for this ending or people would get so mad at me for this yeah. ending that they would start booing. And I remember I was having a panic attack in that theater, and I had Imran and I had Ali Khan and I had my producers right next to me.
Yeah.
And they were like calming me down. And then when the first credits rolled, everyone started clapping
mm-hmm.
and I sank into my seat because I'm like, they're going to be so mad in 30 seconds.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I'm nervous. We're playing at Nifty tonight or in like a couple of hours, and yeah. I'm excited to see if people fall for it. I hope they do. But yeah, I think it'll be cool. And I feel like for me, yeah, it was just a subversion of the genre. It also plays into Imran's like need for, this like perfect world in his head.
Right.
And
right. Cause that's how it starts.
So yeah.
This, I want the fairy tale.
I want this like perfect, whimsical, magical ending. And
yeah.
two, and even playing with like the lighting too, was such an important thing with Ali as well, was like building that whimsical world and building the grounded world and
mm-hmm.
figuring out like what works and how we can like play with more like surreal lighting to
right.
to hop into this magical world. And that's something I really enjoy about this genre. And yeah, I don't know if I was completely rambling in circles, but I think it was a really fun time to be able to just, I don't know. Yeah. Play with your audience. I think the audience
edit too. Yeah.
yeah. I feel like our audiences, you have to treat your audience like they are the smartest people in the room whenever you're making a film, because audiences can tell if you're dumbing something down for them.
Totally. Yeah.
But I do think it's also fun to surprise your audience. So I think there's a balance between treating your audience as the intelligent people that they are and not like dumbing things down or
yeah.
treating them like they know the story, because if they're invested and they're watching the story, they know the story. But also, hey, let me pull out the rug from under you.
Yeah.
As well, and I think that's something that comedy has taught me as well, is like, your audience is very smart, but also your audience is
smart.
How do you subvert them, and how do you make sure that you're treating them as intelligent, but also like surprising them and giving them something new. So that's where that ending kind of came from, is making sure that, yeah, those two things were balanced. And it was hard, but I'm very proud of the ending. Yeah.
Yeah. When we're talking about, because you mentioned the just, you know, rom-com genre is, you know, decades and decades old and filled and full at this point. And so I'm curious, because something I was really thinking about during this was kind of how powerful like queer stories are now when it's not just white people, and how there's kind of added dimension to those romance stories because it's something that is not as kind of, you know, a road that's less, definitely less traveled. I want to say like that kind of storytelling and content is like probably since like certainly before, but I feel like Moonlight is a milestone.
Yes.
And other movies since then, just in those 5 or 6 years. And so, I mean, from your perspective, like, what do you think is the significance of continuing to find new ways to show non-white romantic culture in shorts and in films and in series and moving forward?
For sure. I think there's a few things. I think the first one is a lot of times our protagonists are becoming people of color. And I think like networks and producers are realizing that like, hey, look, like we need to start. There's also, I think like I hate saying this, but there's like a business aspect to it too of like, oh, look at this untapped community that we've been ignoring for too long that is incredibly thirsty for content. Let's give them the content that they need and that they deserve. And I think that's really great. And we're starting to be able to use that as people of color to be like, okay, well, now it's our turn. You know, like we are an audience. Like we can bring out incredible stories. We can bring out people to the theaters. Like you look at like Never Have I Ever, you look at Everything Everywhere All at Once. Like these Asian stories and these POC-led stories are bringing people out and people are looking at them and watching them. And I think people are starting to realize that as well. And I think the added difference, though, that I think that we need to move forward to is there's still a white lead somewhere in there. Like a lot, like I would say majority of the films that I watch that are rom-coms have a white lead.
Can we pair a white person with
a non-white person? Because then they make them more attractive. It makes it also seem like that is the beauty standard we need to achieve.
Right.
And as people of color, like we need to grasp onto that as like the perfect end-all be-all of romance. And I think like
what was that, the one I'm thinking of with the Jonah Hill with the CG kiss that just came out? Anyways, it's on Netflix.
Is it not? Yeah.
It's You People. That's what it is.
Oh, anyways, okay.
An example of, I think that.
Yeah. Where it's like, is that the beauty standard? And especially a lot of these times, realty, it's like these mediocre white boys that are like, okay, like that's great. But there are so many other incredible people of color that I think also deserve to be the attractive romantic lead. Because a lot of times the way the rom-com genre is set up is we have like this like young innocent person that is like looking for love, and then they fall in love with the attractive person, and a lot of times that attractive person is the white person. And I think for me a really, really important thing was making sure that if I were to tell a love story, why can't the person that the person's interested in be brown? Why is that the barrier that we're pushing? Like, it's great that we're having POC stories, don't get me wrong, on the screen in the first place, and we're following these romantic leads. But I think the next step is being like, hey, look, there are these people of color too that as well that can also be the one that is attractive. Mm-hmm. And I mean, you look at Hollywood now, there's like some really, really hot people of color and hot brown people that are up there that are making their way up. But I also think as well, like, there is this standard that is a lot higher for people of color in terms of actors and stuff of being attractive as opposed to just to enter the industry as opposed to being white. So I think like that's where we are next, is just being able to see two like real authentic couple who are couples just come together and show love. And I think that's where we're, and that's where we're ending up. And I think that that's hopefully where I would love to see this industry is just like real grounded love. And like, doesn't matter really what you look like, because we're all capable of finding love. We all deserve love. We're all worthy of love. So I think that's like where I want to see this industry go.
Is
just two authentic, real people finding love.
Yeah. That's amazing. That's as good of a place to kind of start to wrap it up as I think we could possibly have. So we've heard a little bit, other than, you know, this series and everything you're about to work on. Is there anything else that you're working on you can tell us about?
Yeah, I've been working on this other series that I just recently optioned to Crawford Filmworks. That's really fun, and it's kind of in the works right now, along with the other series. I'm also trying to work on a feature, my first feature. It's like a little stripper road trip rom-com movie through Europe called Strip From Home, about this ex-med school student turned go-go dancer who has to road trip across Europe with his ex-boyfriend to reunite with his dying father before it's too late.
Wow.
So it's a little fun rom-com. It's definitely, again, a subversion of the genre. Mm-hmm. The midpoint turns the show on its head, but I think I'm excited for hopefully where that goes. And I'm just in the mood to like just soak all the creative energy in over the next week and just work with some incredible filmmakers.
Cool. Well, where can people go to keep up with your work and follow you?
My Instagram is at Shakil Jessa, Shakil Jessa, JESSA.PDF. Because I thought it was cool. I thought it was like, oh, it's quirky, it's different, it's fun. It's like, oh, haha, it's a file name. I need to find a better Instagram username, though. That is like, it's on my to-do list, actually, of like, I want something like fun.
Rebrand.
Yeah. Something quirky, something cool, but like not trying too hard. But also, I'm trying very, very, very hard to find the studio. So there's that. I want a website. I will make a website, and then I'll post it on my Instagram.
There you go.
That's the energy as well. It's on my to-do list as well to make a website. But yeah, you can find me on Instagram. And yeah.
Sweet. Well, thank you so much for taking some time out of the festival to come talk about your film some more. I'm excited for people to see it later today.
Thank you for having me. This was so fun.
Yeah. And thank you for listening. For more information on NIFTY 2023 or upcoming events, The Talented Youth, and more emerging filmmakers, check out nifty.org or find us on Facebook and Twitter at NFFTY or on Instagram and TikTok at Nifty Film. And for more podcasts from Partyfish Media, search Partyfish Media wherever you listen to podcasts or check out our website at partyfish.media. Party Fish Media acknowledges that it operates and records on Indigenous Duwamish and Puget Sound Coast Salish land that is still home to the Duwamish tribe. This land is stolen in violation of the Point Elliott Treaty of 1855. We are committed to uplifting the name of these lands and community members from these nations who reside alongside us. For more information on this land, its people, or ways you can help, visit duwamishtribe.org or realrentduwamish.org.